Paula, if you would please do the opening words.
Thank you.
We all draw on the well of our own experience in our approach to these issues. I am a child of South Africa. I do not need to imagine what it is like to be treated as inferior. It happened to me. Some were surprised when South Africa, under Nelson Mandela's leadership, wrote into its post-apartheid constitution cast iron protection from discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. It happened because South Africans understood that discrimination is unacceptable on any basis. Real equality admits no exceptions. It was Archbishop Desmond Tutu who first coined the term Rainbow Nation to describe a country that draws strength, not suspicion, from the differences among its people. Pride, not fear, from its diversity. And perhaps that, writ large, is as fair a summary as any of the cause that has brought us here tonight. The world we want really is rainbow colored. It is a world of brilliant diversity where each one of us is free and equal, and where everyone is treated with the same measure of respect and dignity. That was a statement by Navi Pillay, United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, on the occasion of the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia, The Hague, May 17th, 2013.
To face the world's shadows, a chalice of light. To face the world's coldness, a chalice of warmth. To face the world's terrors, a chalice of courage. To face the world's turmoil, a chalice of peace. May its glow fill our spirits, our hearts, and our lives. And not burn the building down.
Actually, we have already invited Patrick to speak, and he has graciously accepted. Patrick Fairbaugh has worked in media and publishing for almost 2 decades. After starting his career at Entertainment Weekly in New York City, he went on to be one of the early art directors of Out Magazine and creative
director of Seattle Magazine. Wonderful. Mm-hmm. At 23, he became one of the youngest senior creatives ever to be hired by the Condé Nast Publications when he went to work for 5 years at Condé Nast Traveler. Patrick is a strong advocate for LGBT equality. Since arriving in Wisconsin in 2005, he's founded the Madison Gay Hockey Association, Our Lives Magazine, and co-founded the Out Professional and Executive Network, known as OPEN. In 2010, Governor Doyle named Patrick an LGBTQ living hero to our state. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Patrick and to have him come up here.
Everybody can hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah? That's fun. So it's good to be back. The last time I was here, I spent a lot of time kind of talking about my personal story and some of the ways that I ended up doing all of that. I figured today the reason that I was approached was to talk about kind of international LGBT rights and how things kind of play out in different cultures around the world. But I figured the best place to start is at home and talk about kind of how things are going within America. So. One of the things that's really unique to gay rights, you know, as with anything else, is it's really attached to culture, and every country, depending on their culture, treats it differently. There's not a universal way to approach this the way that, I don't know if there's a universal way to approach anything, but, you know, America, sort of the gay rights movement started back with Stonewall. I think it was 1960. Okay, well, it started, there was something in the early 40s before that, but... So Stonewall in '69, So, and that, what little people, or people don't know necessarily, is it was actually drag queens and transgender people that kind of led that, and then it was kind of co-opted by gay and lesbian people as the movement went more mainstream. So for a long time here, the goal was just to push to sort of have it taken off and not be listed as a mental illness. So for many years, being gay was just perceived medically and sort of psychologically as a mental illness. I can tell you, growing up in Gary, which is where I grew up, Gary, Indiana, in the 80s even, the economy there and the resources and access to support didn't exist. So there was no resources, there was no access to support. And as a result, the isolation you feel as a gay person, you really believe that you are alone, that nobody else is experiencing this or going through it. And without any of that to turn to, I certainly thought that I had a mental illness for a long time and was too scared to talk about it with anyone. And ended up, and I don't want this to be about my story too much today, but ended up running away from home to go find people who could kind of help support me growing up and becoming, you know, having a healthy life that I would actually enjoy living. So, you know, now we fast forward to today, and, you know, marriage equality is still kind of marching towards being a reality nationally. It started in 2005 in Massachusetts. They passed the first marriage equality law, and well, in America. It actually started globally in 2001 with the Netherlands. So they were the first nation to ever pass anything on marriage equality worldwide. But in the States, as of last week, there are now 14 states that recognize marriage equality. Marriage equality is recognized federally as of this year with the downfall of DOMA. The implementation of it federally is still rolling out very, very, very slowly, because there's a really unique way that you can look at how those benefits are distributed. And this is something that, what's really fascinating to me is when you look at kind of traditional marriage, straight marriage, there are so many things that you can take for granted that you don't even think about, because it just happens once you get your marriage license and sign it, and it's kind of unified across the states. One of them is basically how you're awarded those benefits, and there's two different ways, and there are different ways that federal agencies go about awarding those benefits. Now, it's either by the state you live in or the celebration of place. So it's either awarded based on where you got married or if it's recognized in the state that you live in. So, and that's a real kind of like mosaic quilt at this point of how those benefits are. There are some that, some federal benefits that Wisconsin couples will have access to if they do travel to Minnesota or Iowa, or as of this week, New Jersey, to get married and then return to Wisconsin. Some of the federal benefits that are attached to celebration of place will get awarded here. So, whereas the ones that are more dependent on the state you reside in, like a few of those are Social Security Administration is attached to that. I believe veterans benefits on some level are still attached to that. There was one other one that I'll probably have to come back to. So, but even that, Wisconsin couples, there's another law on the books that is kind of being twisted to apply to same-sex couples here. Which talks about, it was the marriage evasion law. I don't know if anyone's ever heard of that. So it's really antiquated. It was brought forward at a time where they were more worried about people leaving the state to go to a state that had a lower age of consent for marriage and then returning to the state to have that marriage recognized here. But because it's still on the books, that affects same-sex couples who The goal of the marriage evasion law was to get people not to leave the state to enter marriages that weren't recognized by the state, which now applies to same-sex marriage because it's legal in other parts of the country. So I figured we'll talk about the good stuff and then we'll get into the bad stuff a little later, because some countries are leaders on LGBT rights and other countries certainly have a lot of way to go. If not, they're moving backwards. Like I think one of the things I heard, a phrase I heard recently about Russia is that they're marching back towards the medieval ages. So, and if you can go back farther than that, that's probably where they're headed. So a little snip that I'll get to later. Right now, the Russian Duma is waiting on till after the Winter Olympics, until after the attention is taken away from the world eye, to pass a bill that gives the government the power to go into homes and remove children of gay families. So, and you want to talk about what's even worse there, is that those children will then go into orphanages. And I'm sure people have heard about Russian orphanages. So we'll get to that. That's some of the worst that's out there. I mean, other areas that are bad. I didn't mean to start with the bad. Is countries like Iran, who still, they claim that they don't put people to death over it, but there are pictures that, that surface all the time that show, depending on the crime committed, it is on the books that homosexuality can be punishable by execution. So, and depending on the crime, the crime that would warrant execution is two consenting adults. So, you know, how it would not be punishable by execution is if someone was raped or something like that. So, go figure. But let's talk about the good stuff first. So, 2001, the Netherlands became the first nation to pass marriage equality. And actually, another thing I wanted to say is the LGBT rights are not limited to marriage equality by any way to look at things. You know, there are two different components here. There's your sexual identity and your gender identity. So, and those rights are not necessarily tandem to each other. Even, for example, in Wisconsin, you know, Wisconsin was the first state to pass any kind of pro-gay rights legislation in the early 80s when they passed, when they banned discrimination based on employment and housing based on your sexual orientation. So that did not touch gender identity. So for transgender people, they were still vulnerable to discrimination. There were no laws protecting them. In the state of Wisconsin currently, there are only three cities that actually do protect transgender people at this point from those really basic protections, employment and housing. And that is Madison, Milwaukee, and Appleton. So outside of those three places, you know, they're still a very vulnerable population. So, the part of bringing that up is what I'm focusing on right now with the countries I'm going to list off, and in some cases, like even smaller regions or states, is just marriage equality. So this is the only right that I'm really focusing in on. 2001 was the Netherlands. 2003 was Belgium, was Ontario and British Columbia, two Canadian provinces. 2004, Quebec, Massachusetts, the Yukon, which is Canada as well, Manitoba, Nova Scotia, Canada, Saskatchewan, Newfoundland. So there's a bit of a domino effect happening in Canada in 2004, leading up to, in 2005, Spain and Canada both passing it, full marriage equality. Now, what is really fascinating there is Spain went one step farther when they passed it, and they really removed a lot of the obstacles from that kind of prevented gay parents from adopting children. So they made it fully legal for joint adoption for gay couples as well. 2006 was South Africa. You know, South Africa, it was a constitutional loophole that they ended up getting it through. And I think that took most people by surprise. 2008, we have a first when a state extends rights to marriage equality and then rescinds it. So that's California. So California passed Proposition 8, and then it was taken back on a public vote. So during the 2008 presidential election, and Connecticut extended it that year too. New England, and part of this has been, and I'm focusing on America, but this will spread globally quite a bit. So. It's really been focused on the region. The more liberal parts of the country have been very forward on these issues. New England, almost as an entire block, had passed marriage equality before most of the other country had even touched it. So Connecticut was actually, I remember, one of the last ones in New England to kind of reach that place. Norway, Iowa, Sweden, the Coquille Indian tribe in Oregon, in Vermont, got added to the list in 2009. And one of the things that I wanted to bring up here that I found really fascinating, again, marriage equality is only one right. Like that there's so many other areas that this population is vulnerable, or that discrimination, like legalized discrimination, happens. In Sweden, I don't know if they have fully, finally stopped this practice or not, but like transgender people, before they could get access to gender reassignment surgeries, had to be sterilized. So there's you may think a country's doing really good, and then in another area, the second you go to the next right, they're doing something really atrocious, where they're asking or really requiring a population to be sterilized before they can sort of begin any kind of hormone therapy or sex reassignment surgeries. So if they're transgender. So other than that, generally though, Scandinavia has really been leaders on most LGBT issues. Iceland, I believe, became the first place in the world to elect a lesbian prime minister. So 2010, so we're getting close to the current time, was New Hampshire, District of Columbia, the Mexican Federal District, which is kind of unique. Mexico was before us in this sense, but we're almost following their model in this way, where Mexico City and I believe one other area in Mexico, I know one other area, I just don't know which, had passed marriage equality, and then they federally recognized it but left it to the states. So kind of what we just did with DOMA, where it's being federally recognized but really kind of hinges on where the states had. So Mexico City passed it, and then this other region in Mexico passed it. The Mexican states are required to recognize marriages performed in those areas, yet even if they will not allow people to enter those marriages in the Mexican state that they're from. 2011 was New York and the Suquamish tribe in Washington. So Washington, that the whole Northwest is beginning to start to move towards this. Ah, here it was. Quintana Roo is the other place in Mexico. Denmark. For 2012, there are a lot of little territories that I had listed that I don't even know how to pronounce. So the Brazilian Federal District, again, it's like the Brazilian capital, same thing as in Mexico, and then some South Pacific stuff in Maine. 2013, so this year, Maryland, so last year's election, there was something really significant that happened. The marriage equality or any kind of issues of equality there were put to the ballot in four states. And historically, any time that gay rights have been put to a popular vote, which is never a good idea to put civil rights to a popular vote, but historically it had always been defeated. There was not one instance of when LGBT civil rights were put to a popular vote that community was extended any rights. They always had rights taken from them through the form of anti-marriage amendments to state constitutions. So what made 2012 or late 2012 really significant, so a lot of things that happened in the November election were enacted in 2013, was four states took up marriage initiatives, marriage equality initiatives, or three states did, and one was fighting a constitutional ban. So Minnesota was trying to push through a constitutional amendment that would ban marriage equality. And Maine, Washington State, and Maryland were states that all had marriage equality initiatives on the ballot that would grant marriage equality. So, and it was the first time historically that not just one made it through, but all four did. So Maryland, Maine, and Washington State passed marriage equality. And Minnesota defeated the ban, so they were also the first to ever defeat a constitutional amendment. So all of those then kind of went into becoming real in 2013. Maryland, Sao Paulo, and Brazil in 2013 as well. France was a huge one, because one of the things that people might know, may or may not know about France is, if you look at the nations where Catholicism is the strongest, so two of them right at the top, if not number one and number two, are France and Mexico. So when marriage equality passed in France legislatively, there was riots in Paris and Lyon, like in major riots, not just small things. Thousands showed up and were really angry about this. So it was not something that was seen as a real progressive victory for the nation. You know, when you think of Europe, you often, I think of, you know, it being a bit more liberal, or in some ways, I don't like the word socialist, but a bit more socialist than America in that sense. But, you know, France, it caught, because of the religious ties to this, caught a lot of controversy. New Zealand passed it last year. And just recently, is about maybe 2 weeks ago, the Australian Capital Territory. So Australia is starting down the same path that, like, Mexico and we are on, where, you know, they're passing it in one region, then it'll ripple out federally until it reaches that other area. So that's some of the better stuff. Some of the another really, really fun thing that happened this year. Germany became the first country in the world to allow parents to designate a neutral third gender for their children when the child's born. So on the birth certificate, you don't have to indicate at the time if its gender is male or female. You can leave it as neutral for the child to decide later. So that, I thought, was incredible, and I did not see that one coming. So with the work that I do for Our Lives, Our Lives magazine really tries to be kind of the connective tissue, the bigger umbrella that kind of provides support to all of the different gay organizations and communities within Madison. The Facebook page from the magazine I use as a news aggregator. So I end up the same way you'll pick up, you know, the State Journal or the Capital Times or Madison.com, you know, and the news you get there extends beyond, you know, local news. The magazine's Facebook page I use to cycle through wire service stuff from all over the world. So I'm generally fairly connected to, or at least fairly knowledgeable, whenever an issue escalates in a country. So, you know, if you were to ask me on any country-specific position on where they're at when in regards to LGBT rights, I might not be able to tell you. But when something does become a hot-button issue, like Russia is right now, for example, I'm very knowledgeable. You know, some of the ones that, so that group is some of the leaders. I was trying to figure out if there were any specific ones of that I thought were worth noting above others. Sweden, Sweden, like I said, with sterilizing their trans population before they can do any sort of sex reassignment surgeries, is definitely one of the worst things, which is so, I think, but one of the best cases to show how polarized and different your sexual identity is from your gender identity, and those two things are not treated as the same, because you know, in Sweden, and a lot of these places, also worth noting, and I want to move away from marriage equality pretty soon, is marriage equality was not the kind of the first step, or the end game. It is the end game, but oftentimes it wasn't what was first awarded. In a lot of these nations, the first thing that they had to achieve was something similar to marriage, but not marriage in name. So civil unions, and a lot of them, like the Scandinavian nations, Denmark technically was the first nation to award any kind of legal protections and rights to its LGBT citizens when they did some relationship recognition through civil unions. So, and then the Netherlands trumped them by becoming the first nation to offer full marriage equality. So historically, people are going to look back and point to the Netherlands when really Denmark was still offering something, even though they weren't at a place where they were ready to call it full marriage equality. So that's some of the good stuff. Some of the bad stuff on the other end, like I said, Iran, and Iran, I think, is, well, really a lot of the Middle Eastern nations. And one of the things that I think is really important to point out, when you talk about kind of like the Middle East and what their political position on gay rights is it is their political position. Like, I've talked to many different friends who are Muslim, and they can't point to anything in the Quran that kind of shows a right to, you know, or a religious position to have this kind of like venomous hatred towards this population. It always sort of somehow surfaces through political channels, just like how it has here. You know, different political parties have tried to activate the fringe of a religious base to mobilize a voting bloc against something. And you know, it's the same that part. If there was a universal theme to all this, generally it goes back to politics in every country. So that's one thing all of these share. But Iran, the same thing. It is treated, but actually this is something that's really unique about Iran, and again, that shows the difference between sexual orientation and gender identity. Trans people are fairly welcome in Iran, so go figure there. There's not too many restrictions on access to sex reassignment surgeries. Trans women are welcomed into being identified and recognized as women fairly easily. But when it comes to anything where the word sodomy is attached, a lot of their laws and what they perceive as criminal hinges on that word, and if it can be attached to an act that they consider sodomy. And then depending on how that act happened, like I said, if someone was raped, they're probably still going to be punished for it, but probably not to the same extent as two consenting adults, where that's considered the worst, where it would be put to death by execution, generally hanging. Uganda was the hot button last year. So Uganda, I'm trying to figure out what they call it. Oh, so they outlaw homosexuality based on that they consider the act of sex in homosexuality as carnal knowledge of any person against the order of nature. So again, generally hinges on what they consider sodomy. And they had different, you know, prison was if you were lucky. So in Uganda. The bill that was being pushed last year by some radicals sort of in the Ugandan government became known as the Kill the Gays Bill. So, and the goal there was to move the offense to execution as well. So generally for repeat offenders could have been as simple as somebody who was caught twice. So one of the African nations from that region, I can't remember which, I just saw a news item come through where they, during a United Nations meeting where they were going around listing stuff, interrupted the group to say that he thought that the greatest threat against humanity was homosexuality. So, and each nation, and each ambassador to the UN for each nation only had about 2 minutes to spend on what they, and that was what this nation thought was the greatest, to spend their time kind of committing to that platform. But yeah, the Kill the Gay bills was huge. Now, what's really fascinating there with both this bill in Uganda and what's going on in Russia are its ties to America. Very active consultants on both have been the National Organization for Marriage. So people here know it as NAM. NAM is basically the group that has gone in and really tried to push these constitutional amendments in each state, has really tried to defend what they have messaged as traditional marriage on a national level. They're probably one of the biggest anti-gay organizations in the world, I would say. But it's funny that we're exporting that now to nations like Russia and Uganda, because they're turning to us and people who have that knowledge and have done that work and that historical data to move forward whatever their agenda is, their anti-gay agenda in these nations. So Uganda had the Kill the Gays bill, and it was a real hot button because nobody knew if they were going to pass it. There were lots of different, multiple times, sort of what I called like fire alarms that went off where the bill was near passage, and you would see these huge surges of petitions go up online that everybody was trying to take action to get this not brought to a vote. If it did get brought to a vote, it was expected to pass. It didn't, though. I don't know if it has presently, but at least last year when it was a hot button issue, it didn't. I know that it didn't die, though, either, so the chance of it coming back up is probably likely. And then, jumping over to Russia. Russia is the hot button this year, and this has started a few years ago at this point. I have fairly unique ties to Russia in late 2003, I fell for a Russian, and in 2004, I moved to Siberia for him. So the challenge here is without full marriage equality, you don't have immigration equality either. So if I was going to have any hope of this relationship having a chance, there was no way for me to sponsor him to come here. So the reality was I had to go there. And it was unique because it was a very polarized culture depending on where we were at. I was in Siberia and then in Moscow for a while. And I actually felt more welcome in Siberia than I did in Moscow. Moscow politically is a very corrupt place with very polarized political agendas. And in Moscow, activists, LGBT activists, a few years ago were trying to organize a pride parade. And I would say this may have been, first of all, homosexuality was only decriminalized in the 90s in Russia. So where prior to that, they were very actively imprisoning anyone who, I want to say, had definitely committed or been found guilty of committing some kind of gay act. Now, gay act is very broadly defined in Russia. I feel like I need to clarify that because instantly you think of they were caught maybe performing sex of some sort. No. So the current way that this is taking shape is they're calling it gay propaganda, and gay propaganda could be anything that exposes, and the way they framed it is to protect the children from being exposed to non-traditional sexual relationships. So they're calling it gay propaganda. It can be as simple as walking down the street holding your partner's hand. So it's because they see that as an act towards legitimizing an activist approach at getting these relationships recognized. So, up until the 90s, that was an offense that was punishable by being put into prison. It was decriminalized. I remember when I took Alexei to his first gay bar in Russia, which was at this point. So Russia is at where America was at when Stonewall was happening. Actually, they may even be before. I don't even think they've had their Stonewall moment yet. So where the only place you can go to build community or find community is in a bar. So, you know, here we're pretty far past that. In Madison, you don't have to touch the bars if you don't want to really be connected to a thriving community. Where in Russia, that's just not the reality at this point. It wasn't until we got to Moscow that I went to take him to his first gay bar just to let him know that there are other people out there that he can build community with. And I remember we had to go down this boulevard in Moscow, one of the main boulevards, turn off into an alley, and then turn off into another alley from that one, and then had to bang on this big metal door where they slid the little window to make sure you weren't coming in to raid the place before they let you in. So, like, imagine kind of how you feel about yourself and how you fit into the world and what kind of self-esteem or self-worth you have if you feel like you're pushed to that to even find a place where you belong. So, around that period, same period of time in Russia, they were trying to organize their first gay pride parade. And this has been true and kind of almost mimicked in almost all of the former Soviet nations. So, Poland had their, Ukraine, a lot of them had the same, have had very similar stories happening, where not only was there pushback, but against the people who were trying to organize, but when they were turned down, Moscow took a step farther to actually create legislation banning pride parades for the next 100 years. Mm-hmm. So, fairly extreme stuff. But people still tried to organize, not march, but just collect in some kind of protest. And the police essentially rushed the crowd. And if you Google it, it's very easy to find lots of pictures of lots of very bloody people. So some pretty bad stuff there. Well, fast forward, and when St. Petersburg tried to organize a pride parade, the pushback there was even more extreme. A radical lawmaker came up with this concept of the gay propaganda bill, and he really framed and messaged it in a way to try to say that this was to protect the children from exposure to these people and this life and all of those things. And what it was banning the promotion of any form of gay propaganda. So, and like I said, that was left to be very broadly interpreted, from having maybe a rainbow pin on your shirt to holding hands with your partner or caught kissing in public or anything like that. You know, having all that includes having all literature stripped from public places. So like my magazine, for example, couldn't be in public there. You know, go a step farther beyond that. President Putin over there took that law and then escalated it up to being a federal law, a national law. So before it was just a city law in St. Petersburg, but then got pushed up to being just the law of the land in Russia, this gay propaganda law. Putin has also championed closing off adoption to single-parent adoption outside of Russia, because they were seeing that the majority of people that they thought, the perceived majority, was that it was gay people coming into Russia to adopt Russian children. The next step in this was, and this is where you start to sort of see ghosts of Nazi Germany. As those laws, that gay propaganda law, was pushed into the, it was almost a license to harass and a license to bully. So you are currently seeing a lot of neo-Nazi groups in Russia really target gay youth and just follow them home from school, harass them on the way. I speak a little Russian, so I Google this and I can understand what they're saying, but they'll videotape this and then they'll send the videos viral in Russia of them chasing a kid home and like cornering him, you know, pushing him down in the snow and pouring cups of urine on him. So and the police do nothing. So like literally nothing. In one of the videos, you see a cop in the background who isn't even really paying attention. So that's another kind of, I don't know if it was unintended or intended, perhaps, consequence of this, but that's happening with the gay propaganda law, escalating it even more and hinting at more of those sort of ghosts of Nazi Germany. The Russian government has asked now that Russian citizens turn in their gay neighbors to the government, because they, for fear that there may be gay propaganda in their homes. And if that neighbor's turned in, their homes are being searched. So, as you can imagine, I get chills every time I say that. And then beyond that, now they're getting major pushback from the international community, because Russia's hosting the Winter Games this winter, you know, in Sochi, which is a Black Sea city. And that's drawing a lot of attention to the civil rights violations the international civil rights violations that are going on there right now. Russia's trying to play that down quite a bit. The Olympic Committee has really been atrocious at trying to protect anybody traveling to Russia for the games, whether it's a spectator, whether it's somebody that's involved in the production of the games, or the athletes themselves. They're all at risk traveling there, and there's not been a clean answer from the Russian government on any level on if that law will be actively enforced or not in Sochi during the games. A couple groups have kind of taken it into their own hands to be activists during the games. Team Germany, I thought this was really a very fun, clever thing that they did. When they chose their team uniforms, are rainbows. So, and there's talk right now, Coca-Cola is talking about having rainbows printed on their cans, because they're one of the official sponsors and vendors of the games. So it's ways that the world can kind of try to exert some sort of influence into Russia, you know, based on that. And then, like I said before, the last piece of this, or the most, it's probably not the last, but the next piece of this, is Russia's waiting. The bill's been tabled as of last week until after the games, when it'll be brought back, where they say that where we give the state the permission to go into the home and remove children of gay parents. So it's one of maybe perhaps the worst, you know, form of persecution that I've seen in you know, the world today. But that, I hate to end on a down note, but I mean, that might be the right time to open stuff up if there are any questions. I wish I honestly understood and knew myself. So I think part of it is maybe there are too many unknown variables on how hormone therapy may affect, like for example, a transgender man. There was a lot of news a few years ago. We're out in Oregon. A transgender man became pregnant and was going to have a baby. That was that way, the couple's path. So the cisgender woman in the relationship, it was a heterosexual relationship where one partner was a transgender male and the other partner was a biological cisgender female. So cisgender is a term that's been lifted up by the trans community that means how you see yourself and perceive yourself matches your biological sex. Like I think I could probably say most people in this room are cisgender. So a cisgender woman and a transgender man were in a heterosexual relationship, right? You have a man and a woman in a relationship. The cisgender woman could not become pregnant, so the transgender man agreed to be, carry the child. And that made a lot of news around the world because you got a very tabloid-friendly headline of a pregnant man. So I think a lot of the concerns are, and maybe as this happens more, it'll become less of a concern, is they don't know how the hormone therapy or any of that stuff may affect the pregnancy. I know President Obama is getting a lot of pressure on Russia right now because of how much world attention, because of the Olympics, Russia is getting to find ways to extend asylum to gay Russians. But I have not seen any movement on that. A very kind of like little fun trivia fact, the Gay Hockey League in Madison is now the biggest hockey league in Madison, gay or straight. We have 120 players, we make up 8 teams, we basically turn Hartmeyer Ice Arena into a community center every Sunday night. So, I'll be there later today. One of the challenges I had, and this had to do with me not being able to reconcile my gender identity with my sexual orientation. I growing up in Gary, with very limited resources or exposure to a thriving gay community, did not have a matured way of understanding how I fit into that world. And part of what I mean by that is, the only way I could identify with the emotional maturity that I had at the time that someone was gay is if the man was really effeminate or if the woman was really butch. So I felt really isolated and alone because I didn't know how, as a masculine male, I fit into this world. And as a result, I just thought I was mentally sick. So I think one of the most hyper-masculine places, like arenas left, is sports still. And when I did try playing sports, it was still very common to hear gay slurs used very regularly, like among the teams, but even among leadership and among coaches, as ways to think that if they could insult the person, that would motivate them to try harder. But it was always used in the form of an insult, like it was not good. And that continues today. Like I can tell you, when I've sat in on scrimmage hockey groups in Madison, it's the same for the men's scrimmage groups that I've been here. So if you take a population that's been pushed out of sports, like I think one of the reasons that the first areas to lift up and become visible were, like for gay men, like theater and things like that, was because it was a community that was really welcoming and accepting. So, people moved towards that because they needed support and resources more than they probably needed theater. They just needed that connection to a community. So that wasn't always an option for sport. Things like the Hockey League try to create that safe space where people can go and experience that growth that comes from feeling competitive and feeling athletic and feeling all those areas without feeling like they're going to get pushed out or being put into an unsafe space. So what I'm seeing that is really kind of cool is the work that's happening there is spreading, where we have more allies coming into the group and learning. Privilege is a unique thing, and kind of what makes it unique is often the people experiencing it are blind to it. So, the allies are coming in completely having their eyes open to all of the things that they are blind to. So, experiencing kind of what hockey would look like if it was a safe space. So, and then they're able to take that back to their groups wherever they go.
I think we've kind of run out of time, so. Okay. I'm sure Patrick will be around for a few minutes afterward and you can ask him questions. Cool.
Thank you, Patrick, and I do hope you can stay a few minutes for you. Enough time between now and hockey.
And our final words today are from Maria Gomez, Coordinator for International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission's Regional Program in Latin America and the Caribbean, comments on the U.S. Supreme Court's rulings on DOMA and Proposition 8. In the context of advancing same-sex marriage in Latin America and the Caribbean, the U.S. Supreme Court decision may impact legal strategies both for and against same-sex marriages in the region. At a minimum, it will be a source of legal debate for the meaning and notion of equality in those countries that have gained rights through the courts. Importantly, LGBT rights are also progressing at a political level in countries like Argentina and Uruguay, offering models of good practices for other countries in the Americas, including the United States.
Thank you. Greet your neighbor, go in peace. Talk to Patrick if you have a chance. We'll see you next week.